Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to find about how to live a longer and healthier life. We're going to talk about some stem cell research and also how changing the diet and not being deficient in beta carotenes, vitamin D, and vitamin C can protect your immune system, augment your body's ability to fight viruses of all types, and all of this comes from peer-reviewed journals. Also today, from Melvin Goodman, Counterpunch, Colin Powell, willful victim of the Central Intelligence Agency deceit. I'll bet less than five people in this entire audience know this information I'm going to share. It's very important. Now, why is it important? Because what Melvin Goodman is showing, which we proved years ago, before anyone else did a challenge to the New York Times and Judith Miller on Curveball, the so-called Iraqi specialist in biological weapons that became the basis of Dick Cheney's efforts to get the CIA and its operatives inside the CIA and the other intelligence agencies to agree that this was a good way of going into Iraq. Well, of course, they had alternative motives, and Halliburton has made hundreds of billions of dollars because of that. So this lets you know, where were the whistleblowers? Where were the people who knew the truth and never spoke it, including Colin Powell? Colin Powell had the power, the prestige, the reputation. He could have gone on national television. He could have gone 60 Minutes and say, I was lied to intentionally, and unfortunately, then I pass that lie forward to the American public. Here are the people who lied to me, and therefore they're still in power, and they should be held accountable. He chose not to. So we do not have, unfortunately, the type of people in power who, when they see corruption, are willing to speak to it. So then we become victims of it. So that's one commentary today that you're going to hear. Also, we're going to take a look at a very important piece called Mayhem and Madness, Authoritarian Monsters Wreak Havoc on Our Freedoms, from John W. Whitehead and Nasha Whitehead. Also today, there is a controversy surrounding the comments made by one of the great minds of the 20th and 21st century, Noam Chomsky. And I have my own particular point of view on that. But we're going to hear from Jimmy Dore and the Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal, who took issue with what Noam Chomsky was saying. You're going to hear what he said. And unfortunately, I believe that I hold a different opinion than Robert Kennedy Jr., who I got a note from this morning saying that, you know, this was sad. That is true. It was sad. But it's not from anything due to aging. This has to do with a person stepping out of the boundaries of where they spent their whole career, being accurate more often than not, into an area where they're completely unprepared for the science and understanding it. You'll hear the comments, and because these comments are going to be used by the pro-vaccine people to attack, even to arrest the people who refuse to. And it's a horrible thing to hear someone of such great mind make these unscientific, irrational statements. But we will play them, but I'll give a commentary and try to put it into a proper context so that we stay on base, being humane to a person who's done so much throughout his career, being on the right side of issues. Unfortunately, on this one, he's on the wrong side of the issue. Also, today, we're going to be hearing from Kim Iverson and Fire Fauci. She says the history of his flip-flops and his lies that should force his retirement. Now, mind you, that's the mainstream being more center-left. And when they start to say time for Fauci to go, there are cracks in the foundation of his impenetrable ego. Let's see what happens from it. Also, the coddling of the American mind Jonathan Haidt is being interviewed at the 92nd Street Y. This is part two of what we shared yesterday. Yesterday it was very important because it showed what happens when we think as a group without the individual critical thought that's necessary to make the best choices in life. And we're seeing the consequences of groupthink right now. It's tearing America apart. So we're going to have his insightful wisdom to share with us. That's our program. We have a lot to share, and of course, we always begin with the latest on health. From the medical school of Ningbo in China, published in Cancer, Nutrition and Cancer, it shows that when they looked at over 1.7 million people in this meta-analysis, meaning you're looking at multiple studies and seeing what comes together, they're finding that the omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids is associated with improved lung cancer survival. When you consider how many people have lung cancer, this is a big deal. Quote, to the best of our knowledge, this is the most comprehensive systematic review and meta-analysis to date to quantifiably evaluate the association between intake of fish and polyunsaturated fatty acids and the risk of lung cancer. So says the professor at the medical school. And they looked at all the different studies, and what they found is those who consumed the most fish oil had a substantially lower risk of lung cancer. And so that's terrific. Quote, each 5 gram per day increment of omega-3 intake was associated with a 5% lower risk of lung cancer. Well, 5 grams is not a lot. So therefore, you could easily, just with that alone, lower your risk by about 20%. From the Technical University of Denmark comes a study about immunodeficiency affects intestinal microbiome, meaning the good bacteria in your gut. And this is the largest study of intestinal bacterial composition, also called the intestinal microbiome, to date in persons with immunodeficiency selective IgA deficiency. And what they found is that when you are immunodeficient, and by the way, a lot of people with and without AIDS are immunodeficient. People who have diabetes are frequently immunodeficient, cancers immunodeficient, dementia immunodeficient. I see the blood results with all the people I counsel, so I've seen tens of thousands of these. And I can tell you, it really wreaks havoc throughout your body. So the very first rule is detoxify the person immediately, get the heavy metals out. Then at the same time that you're detoxifying them, then you start to rebuild the intestine, because the intestine and the gut bacteria augments your entire body's immunity. So if you're the average person eating the average diet, you're going to have a very toxic colon. If, however, you're that 7% making very conscious, positive choices to eat healthy, you're going to have healthy bacteria, hence a stronger immune system. Well, at a time when all of us should be concerned about the quality of our immune system, this is important, because we're all, and I'm going to say this again, but in context, I believe that virtually all Americans will be exposed over the next 2 to 3 years to the COVID virus. As a nation, we are extremely sick. We are the sickest nation on the planet per population. And since we only have about 235 million Americans, and you compare that to 1.3 plus billion in China and 1.3 plus billion in India, and yet we have more sick people per population, then it shows you that we're doing just about everything wrong when it comes to our diet. Now, the fact that we have 7%, which is still over, well, it's 25 million people, that's still a lot of people. So it's not as if it's a secret what you have to do to be healthy. It's not as if there's examples all the time in our general culture and in the media, in people's lifestyles, showing here's how you're healthy, here's how you're not. So when we have an understanding of what leads to health or what leads to disease over a period of time, then what responsibility do we as individuals have? And this is particularly personal to me because in my family, including my extended family, so you're talking about a lot of people, not a single person made any healthy choices that I could ever see. They all smoked. They all drank. They all ate bad diets. They all were overweight. And they didn't exercise. And they didn't deal with stress appropriately. And so they didn't live long lives. Yet try to talk to them about this, and all you got was an argument in return. You wanted them to live, but you knew what the outcome was going to be. And that's always sad, when you know something can change, yet the person doesn't want to change. I'm sure many of you have faced similar situations. So here's a question. You can call in throughout the program and address it. If people know better but don't do better, what then can we, who care about these people, do to try to motivate them or not? 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. So just this one study showed that if you're immunodeficient, you're going to have a toxic microbiome, which means you're going to have a very low-functioning, ineffective immune system at a time when we really need it. Why? Because you should do everything humanly possible now to build up your immune system and have also a plan B. You have a preventative protocol, and then you have a medical protocol. And you should have everything you need in advance. That's how you deal with this. And I know a lot of people in this audience have dealt with it appropriately, and a lot of people haven't. I know people who've gotten COVID, but because they were on the preventative program, it was a very minor case, sometimes asymptomatic, and they didn't even know they had COVID. They tested for the positive antibodies. So that's good. But also I know people in this audience who listen every day, knew what they should have. I published 3 articles on it, free, it's there, download, all coming from PubMed, peer-reviewed literature, and yet they chose not to because they didn't see themselves as that vulnerable until they almost died. Then I get the call when they're in the hospital, you know, to help them get out and get their health back. It says a lot. I'd like to hear from some of you who have used the healthy protocols, and as a result, how you are today, even if you've had COVID, and those of you who've chosen not to use the protocols and you got COVID, and how did you get through that? And what lessons have you learned? I'd like to hear from you. Also from Strathclyde University in the United Kingdom comes a study looking at how light stimulation can fight off the onset of dementia. We have a lot of people suffering from dementia and a lot more going to be suffering. Researchers are exploring how to enhance brain activity through light stimulation in the hope of advancing new strategies to prevent Alzheimer's. The study is investigating new ways in which buildup of a protein I talk about all the time, which is toxic to the brain, known as beta amyloid, A-M-Y-L-O-I-D, could be halted with the use of light stimulation in areas of the brain which are particularly vulnerable to Alzheimer's. Scientists at the university are in a 14-month study which can lead to new preventative strategies for Alzheimer's. And by the way, a lot of people are doing nothing, thinking there's nothing you can do. There's a lot you can do. You know, if you want to stimulate a healthy neuron activity in the brain, you can use light. And these therapies are available now. I know some of the people who are researching it, they're coming up with some very positive outcomes. And it can enhance fast brain waves, which are impaired in people with Alzheimer's. And also you can enhance brain waves that can reduce buildup of the toxic protein, but you've got to turn off inflammation, and that you can do with what you drink and with what you eat. You can really turn it down. Quercetin turns it down. It's just one example. Also, from the Walter and Elisa Hall Institute of Medical Research, comes a study about changing your diet to help reduce pregnancy complications in women with type 1 diabetes. Here's where a clear change in your gut microbiome during pregnancy could contribute to complications in both the mother and the baby if you continue eating an unhealthy diet. taking in the colas and the sugar, the junk. But it also reverses. You want to turn off intestinal inflammation. You want to get rid of the itises, ileitis, colitis, etc. And you do that by having foods or beverages that are anti-inflammatory, like your green vegetables, anti-inflammatory, your red fruits, anti-inflammatory, your juices, like celery and cucumber with lemon, anti-inflammatory. So the things you can do, and that can really help you if you have type 1 diabetes. Also, from the latest issue of Medicine in Science and Sports and Exercise, Americans need at least 5 hours per week of physical activity to prevent some cancers. That's the latest study. And they looked at 32,000 women and 14,000 men to come up with this. And people are just not physically active. And especially in the South, they pointed out Kentucky, West Virginia, Louisiana, Tennessee, and Mississippi. They have the lowest proportions of people who don't exercise. Whereas in Utah, Montana, Wyoming, Washington, and Wisconsin, they have the most exercises. And this definitely leads to less types of cancer: breast cancer, endometrial cancer, colon cancer, stomach cancer, kidney cancer, esophageal cancer, adenocarcinoma, and urinary bladder cancer. So you can make a big difference by exercising every day. And also from the University of Eastern Finland comes a study: by increasing your whole grains, you can significantly reduce the economic impact of type 2 diabetes. This is published in Peer Reviewed Nutrients. And how many times have I told, well, Gary, you know, I can't eat healthy because it's too expensive? Just the opposite is true. A healthy vegan plant-based diet is 30% or less expensive than the average American diet. If you doubt me, look at a pound of lentils and then a pound of beef. Now, by dry weight, you're going to get about the same amount of protein, but look at the cost, and then look which has fiber, the lentils, no fiber, the meat. Arachidonic acid, which is highly inflammatory, the meat, no arachidonic acid, the lentils, which provide you, and then you can go through this. So we've just got to get out of our mindset that we're going to be dependent upon something and start to really make changes. Also, mulberries are delicious. I'm sure many people in this audience grew up with a mulberry bush. And it's actually a tree. And you start to see the little purple ones, and then they get bigger, and they can get 2 or 3 inches long if you fertilize the trees. And they're very healthy, extremely tasty. According to the Chinese Academy of Science, mulberry extract activates the brown fat, shows promise for obesity treatment. So get the extract because it's rich in what? Mulberries have rutin, R-U-T-I-N, and that can activate the BAT in our bodies to increase metabolism and facilitate weight loss. So it's not difficult to get yourself some frozen mulberries, dried mulberries. They last almost forever. I got a big 3-pound bag, and I use some every day in a smoothie. So you can get it in there. That's the latest on health and healing. We're almost 20 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go to this clip from Jimmy Dore. And he's critical of Noam Chomsky. In this case, he is legitimate. Normally, I would defend Chomsky on so many issues, but on this one, there is no defense. There's only that kind of cringeworthy, I wished he hadn't have said it, but he did. All right? And let's play the clip first. We'll go to a break, then we'll play the clip.
Let's talk about Noam Chomsky, because this is super important. So this guy is Andy Slavitt. Now, if you don't know who he is the senior advisor for COVID response. He was the past head of Medicare, Medicaid for Obama, author of Preventable. So he's the former Biden White House senior advisor for COVID response. That's who he is. And what did he tweet out? What did he say? He said, given Delta's contagiousness and the fitness of future mutations in order to beat it, this means that SARS-CoV-2 will be contagious enough that everyone will get the virus. Everyone is going to get the virus. I've reported this before because why do I know this? Because that's how the science is. And also because I watch John Campbell on YouTube, who is a PhD, and he teaches nursing. And he's the one who showed me the research on his show that now all the experts are agreeing everyone is going to get the virus at some point. So it's going to go from a pandemic to an endemic. And the countries that are opening up now, they're not opening up because they beat the virus. They're opening up because they realize they have to live with the virus. That's what's happening. Look at places like Iceland. Look at places like Denmark. Look at places like Sweden, Finland. They're realizing they have to live with it. And that's what's called an endemic. An endemic is when you decide you're going to live with it and treat it. Here's Noam Chomsky being asked about unvaccinated people.
What are your thoughts on mandating vaccines?
Well, it's a mixed story. I think people who refuse to accept vaccines, I think the right response for them is not to force them to, but rather to insist that they be isolated. If people decide I am willing to be a danger to the community by refusing a vaccine, they should then say, well, I also have the decency to isolate myself. Okay, I don't want a vaccine, but I don't have the right to run around harming people. That should be a convention. Enforcing is a different question. It should be understood, and we should try to get it to be understood. If it really reaches the point where they are severely endangering people, then of course you have to do something about it. So if someone, if smallpox turns out to become rampant again, and some people are insisting on running around to public places where they might have smallpox, well, you've got to do something about it.
So, and what he wants to do is have an authoritarian government isolate them from society. Now, why is he wrong on that 100,000%? Well, because as I told you, everyone's going to get it. So you have to prepare for when you get it. And you're going to get it from an unvaccinated person or you're going to get it from a vaccinated person. Because as the science now shows, that vaccinated person, people also shed the virus. And that you can get the coronavirus from a vaccinated person. In fact, a Harvard study I just did a story on showed that the counties and countries with the highest vaccination rates have the highest transmission rates. So this idea that Chomsky has is anti-science. He's not a virologist. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just a scared old man. He's responding through fear. And how does he respond from fear? He wants to oppress someone else. He wants to become an authoritarian. And that's just an old man who's afraid. That's not science. That's not intellect. That's not logic. That's anti-science and anti-logic. We are all going to get the virus, so you have to prepare for when you get it. It's not going away. As the director, Joe Biden's director of COVID response, told us. So what Chomsky's saying here is incorrect, authoritarian, and a nightmare. And guess what? He doubled down on it. Here's from you, Matt. Here's Chomsky doubles down on his previous call to segregate. Listen to what he says this time.
When you talk about folks having the freedom to, you know, separate if they don't want to abide by these vaccine mandates.
By the way, can I just say, saying we're going to separate you from society might not be the best way to get people to comply with your vaccine request. That's, I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say that's not good persuasion. Okay.
What would that look like on a practical level? Does that mean that folks need to just stay home and have like groceries delivered to them? Does it mean like separated communities of folks who are unvaccinated, or just, you know, how do you think this would practically play out?
Same way as with people who say that I don't want to accept traffic rules. I suppose there were people who said it's an attack on my liberty to make me stop at a red light.
Okay, guess what a red light isn't? An invasive medical procedure. How about that? That's not what's sitting at a, hey, how many people get a heart inflammation from sitting at a red light? Do you know what the study on that is? Zero. How many people get tinnitus from sitting at, how many? What are the long-term effects of sitting at a red light? Nothing. So this, he's conflating a medical procedure, a forced medical procedure with a traffic light, which is the dumbest thing in the world I've ever heard someone say wearing a beard. That is pretty dumb. That's so dumb, I know it's dumb. That's not based on science.
Jimmy is correct on his facts. I would have handled this differently. First, because you have to pull back and see the sacrifices Chomsky has made, how right he has been on so many occasions where he was the one, not Jimmy Dore, not his critics, he was the one going out to debate. Did you see the debate when he debated William F. Buckley? Brilliant debate. Chomsky was called the father of modern linguistics. He was one of the founders of the field of cognitive science. He's one of our nation's most outspoken critics of U.S. foreign policy, neoliberalism, state capitalism, nuclear weapons, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the war on terror after 9/11, and he also was a main critic of the mainstream media and its biases. He is also the Institute Professor Emeritus at MIT. He was Professor Laureate of Linguistics, University of Arizona. Now imagine how prolific in the scholarship. He wrote 150 books dealing with linguistics, war, politics, mass media. He was the co-founder of the Universal Grammar Theory, and that allowed all of us not to be indoctrinated by B.F. Skinner's absurd behavioralism nonsense. Politically, he is aligned with libertarian socialism. He rose to national attention back in 1967 in his opposition to the Vietnam War. And at the same time, he began to give us a history lesson, an honest history lesson about American imperialism. I have to respect someone who was arrested multiple times, placed on Nixon's enemy list, harassed by the IRS, and was constantly watched and monitored. If you haven't read what all of us hopefully have read and learned from, Manufacturing Consent, it is his most renowned work and his latter work to expose the Indonesian occupation of East Timor. And although Jews, due to his meeting with a Palestinian prime minister, when was banned from having entry into Israel, he did not pull back. He is one of the early supporters of the World Social Forum, started around 2000 in Brazil. So take a look at what he did. Now, was he misspoken? Yes. But you can throw a feather at someone or you can throw a brick. Jimmy threw a brick without looking at the fact that how many times has Jimmy been wrong on an issue? In fact, how many times have all of the progressives, real progressives, been wrong on issues only to find out later, oh, okay, I was on the wrong side of that issue. What if you were condemned in a like manner? So let us temper the attacks against such a noble and wise person, even as he erred on this one. First off, he has not read by any measure, you can tell that, the Great Burlington Edict that has been written by the top professor at Stanford, Harvard, and Oxford University that showed over a year ago, I'm one of the signers of it also, along with about 80,000 other scientists and physicians, that many aspects of the approach to the pandemic were wrong. scientifically wrong, completely provable wrong. And we have some of the brightest people on the planet who have signed this. There are over 100,000 physicians and scientists who will tell you that if people are not choosing the vaccine, why don't we ask first, how much honest information have you gotten from the media about the side effects that the vaccine is causing people to shed? We were the first radio program in the United States to broadcast that. And we said, be wary, because the people most likely to spread the deviant, Delta variant, will be the vaccinated. And that was also, the first interview was by the person named Dr. Bosch on this program. He was demonized, but he was right. No one goes back and says, I'm sorry, you were right. You were ahead of all of us. You saw what we didn't see. We were blinded by our ideology or just lack of brilliance. He was more brilliant. So we now know, and I played a clip yesterday, a fully vaccinated person, pro-vaccine, but then his mother and father vaccinated, his wife vaccinated, his ex-wife vaccinated, his children are all vaccinated, and yet he tested negative, and therefore he thought he was safe. He was still shedding, and he infected all of them, and now they're really sick. Well, he was angry because we were told, get vaccinated and go back to normal. It was a lie, and they knew it was a lie. They've been withholding the true numbers of how many people have been injured and dead. But even historically, Chomsky would be the first to say, if you gave him a paper and say, Professor Chomsky, here is the outcome of the 1976 swine flu fiasco. About 50 million Americans, more or less, were vaccinated. And yet, we had 20 known deaths. And over the next year, we would see about double, a little over double that, nearly 50. And it was banned. It was outlawed immediately. For pharmaceutical drugs, not injectables, when it gets to 15 dead, it's banned. Well, here, minimally, we can prove 30,000 dead Americans. That's minimal, more likely closer to 200,000, according to Dr. Rose and others. And you've got over 750,000 to 1 million injured, and many of those seriously and with lifelong disabilities. Do you believe that it's reasonable then for the many people within the medical community, many of the nurses and doctors seeing the side effects of people vaccinated coming in with all these life-challenging infections who did not have COVID before the vaccine, and all these people got COVID from the vaccine, do you think that it's reasonable for these people then to say, before we go further with any more vaccines, we should have proper studies done for the full length of the study, and then make decisions based upon reason science? I'm sure that he would say that's, of course, that's reasonable based upon how many adverse effects you've had and how much effort the mainstream establishment, including the media you've been critical of, including the New York Times you've been critical of, have lied to us, out and out lied. The things that could help us early on with orthodox drugs, they banned, even sending out letters from the state medical boards, that purely political, out of the AMA, telling a doctor, if you use these drugs, you'll lose your license. So telling a doctor that can no longer practice medicine, that's no longer medicine and public health, and he would recognize that. So you see, everything we've been told is a lie when it comes to how to deal with this, because of special interest. But what would also other people, Noam Chomsky was not alone. He just strayed out of his comfort zone. And at a certain point in life, if you're not an expert in a field, it is best to simply pull back and suggest they speak with people who are. Howard Zinn, Sheldon Wolin, it was from him teaching at Princeton as a philosopher that we learned about inverted totalitarianism. Hannah Arendt, James Baldwin, Theodore Roszak, Gore Vidal, Reinhold Niebuhr, Martin Luther King, W.E.B. Du Bois, John Rawls, Ralph Nader, Thomas Merton, Michael Foucault, Margaret Mead, Bertrand Russell, Theodore Adomo, Viktor Frankl, John Dewey, Gloria Steinem, Barbara Ehrenreich, and thousands of other brilliant individuals who challenged the establishment when it was wrong. Do you think any of those individuals would embrace and hire the head of the CIA, to hire the head of the National Security Agency, to trust in the national security state that has been lying to us, invading countries for its entire existence? Do you think that they would embrace it? No, they wouldn't. But then how would they have answered the same issue given to them? We will never know. But at least we knew this time someone that was lionized throughout his career for the great work he did, the courage he had, should be given some respect and just accept he was wrong. You don't need to go further than that. There is no need for punitive words, which we're so capable of throwing around today. We're going to look for your calls, 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And again, if you're a person that made mistakes and then didn't do the protocols you should have, either preventatively or medically, and then you had to learn harsh lessons, call us. If you did the right things and you're healthier today and alive today because you did, in no small measure, call us. Let's start by saying hello to Gwen from Manhattan. Hi, Gwen, your turn.
Hi, Gary. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Hello, Mr. Gary Noel. You're so fabulously wonderful. I just wanted to weigh in on the conversation because I hear your frustration. My sister right now has cancer, a bladder, and blood cancer, and just will not give up sugar at all. She will never give up sugar. She's very obese. But, you know, I think that what's not being taken into the question here is the mental capacity of people in America and maybe all over the world. And I think that we are a very addicted nation. And if we're not being addicted to food, we're addicted to cigarettes or alcohol or shopping. And I think that that's usually at the root of many disorders, because I think people completely understand the logic of a healthy, balanced meal in order to promote health. It makes sense. But the disease, and I call it the disease because it turns into a disease. It turns into the disease of morbid obesity and cancer, lung cancer. And this is all being propelled through a system of addiction. And so I think that one of the things that I have learned is that there's all kinds of free groups that can help you address the underlying issues. You can't get to a healthy body weight if you can't understand the reason why you are so addicted. Yeah, sugar has chemicals in it that really have that addiction going. It's very addictive eating sugar. But usually when people want to eat huge amounts of sugar, it's because there's something else bothering them. It's like, what's bothering Gilbert Grape? And there is something bothering Gilbert Grape and a lot of Americans. And this is what we have been used and we've encouraged to use these things as coping mechanisms. Even when people go to Alcoholics Anonymous, guess what? They just push them over into the next addiction, and that's sugar. So, okay, you're not drinking the alcohol anymore. We'll give you some Hershey Kisses to suck on. And then many people in that program end up being very heavy because they learned a different coping mechanism. So I think that one thing that's always missing in conversations when you're talking about weight or other kinds of addictions is what is mentally going on. I mean, I just don't think people are stupid. I think that they hear what other people are saying, and they almost are in the throes of an addiction which doesn't allow them to do what's in their best interest. So that's just kind of my observation.
Well, those are very insightful. I believe they're accurate. In fact, it ties in with something that I was just talking with my staff this morning, and that is that beginning the first week of January, I will have finished my latest two documentaries that we're working on in post-production right now. Two, one really hard-hitting, but one on aging. Very positive documentary, because I've been filming all the work I'm doing with these original clinical studies, and those are both are going to be finished in the next 8 weeks. But then I'm starting three new documentaries. One's called Addictive Nation, on the nature of all underlying causes of addiction and the best holistic therapies. And another is I'm going to finally finish Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? The New Face of Poverty in the United States. And we have a hard time wrapping our mind around the fact that someone's in poverty, yet they've got a car, a flat screen TV, they're obese, You know, yeah, they got that way for a reason. Credit. And who profits from that? A whole industry. So we're going to deal with the new poverty. It's going to get worse, not better. In fact, I'm opening up the film showing the current debt clock, and then I'm going through each area of our society and showing how much debt each one has. None of those can really be paid back. And so we're adding more debt with promises that things will be better. Which promises have any of these people, no matter what party, fulfilled from the past, outside of the corporate promises that they do fulfill? And then a third special is manufacturing madness. I'm going to take on the entirety of the mental health field because, as a whole, psychiatry is a fraud. And there's no science to back it up. And even psychiatrists, who I've filmed already, will agree with that. But what are the solutions then? How can we help people who have conditions like bipolar or schizophrenia or depression, anxiety? So half of it's dealing with the crime against humanity of pretending to have solutions, diagnosis, and treatments that are fraudulent and always have been. I'm going to go clear back to the first psychiatrist in American history, Benjamin Rush, who was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence and who bled George Washington to death, and bring it right up to date. So, in fact, I was saying that if any people in the audience want to be a part of it by just observing, because I want to try to get another generation of people to become citizen archivists, documentarians, short documentaries, maybe 10 minutes, 20 minutes long, not the long ones. It takes way too many resources and time in scholarship to do those, but I'm going to be open to that. We'll announce that later on in December. Thank you, Gwen, for your call. And you'll see a lot of what you're discussing because we all come from that background. We all have something similar. Chris from Long Island. Hi, Chris. Your turn.
Buddy. My question is derived from the last caller, Gwen. Was talking about addictions.
Yes.
So I had addictions too growing up, and I can relate to the coping mechanism of going one to the other. So my advice would be to, I'm a vegetarian, so I made the distinction between electric foods and dead foods. So fruits and vegetables have electric, basically energy to them compared to processed foods, which are dead and laden with chemicals. So I use that to help my family and friends to make that basic distinction of eating a candy bar, which is made in a factory, where you can get a fruit or something that's made from a farmer's market or available to help you with your longevity in life. And I think that's kind of what I use to help others, to show them the basic distinction of good health. And also something else that I also did recently was I did a parasite flush for 17 days, which also helped me regulate the sugar in my body and showed how addictive or how much I love sugar with doing this flush. And basically, I want to know your perspective on these pathogens that I believe people who are obese or unhealthy have a load of. I think even healthy people have parasites. But in terms of how do people who have addictions, I believe they have so much parasites that they don't know what's happening inside their microbiome and all this stuff. So I just want to know what you thought about that, but I love the show, Gary, and you're the best.
Thank you. Parasites are a big problem, and it doesn't matter whether a person's obese or not. You can have sushi and get parasites and worms. You can have kibbe, a raw meat that generally is given. It's a traditionally a Syrian and Armenian dish. You can make it with diced up garlic, onions, parsley, and put a mustard in it, and it's raw meat. Very dangerous. You cannot wash your hands and pick up a parasite from someplace you've been. So parasites are a big problem. They drain people's energy, and a proper cleanse, a proper detoxification helps lessen those. I'll deal with that on an upcoming program. I don't have time today. But you're absolutely right about the difference between the energy factor of live foods and the energy factor of dead foods. Dead, diseased, and processed, that's what the average American consumes 80% of the time. Healthy foods, on the other hand, look at the vitality. Look at the science. You have zero, not a single study in the peer-reviewed literature we could find showing you that eating the standard American diet was good for your health, good for your heart, good for longevity. And yet we can have hundreds of studies showing that a healthy plant-based diet or a similar, like a Mediterranean diet, is good to prevent heart disease and cancers and dementia and weight gain and live a longer life. So you're on the right track there. Thank you. We're going to take a break in a moment because I want to get into this talk by Jonathan Haidt before the end of the show. But I'll still take room at the end of the show for your calls. Just one quick announcement today, and that is that we have a special for you. And I'm going to give you this special. I'm not going to take a whole lot of time with it. And in fact, here's what it is. I wanted a product that could really make a difference, a functional product, something we all need, something everybody benefits from. So I selected cardio stuff. Now, there's more to it. I'm giving you an award-winning documentary, Power Aging. I'm also giving you award-winning documentary, Reversing Heart Disease and Stroke Naturally, as an educational tool to show you the this is hours long, by the way, to show you the long-term implications of making even small changes on a weekly basis with exercise. I even get into the following during the course of his original study, going back, God, it's over 35 years, the original study that showed you could reverse heart disease. Up to that point, there was no science that showed you could do it. Balloon angioplasty, stents, coronary bypass, yes, you could do that. But that wasn't corrective. That was only ameliorating some of the adverse events, but you were still at risk. It just bought you a little time. But Dean Ornish, the great cardiologist, did this study, and I filmed it. I was there. And no one changed in medicine. Of all the, at that time, around more or less 700,000 doctors, there was no change whatsoever. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine and the British Medical Journal of the Lancet. Again, all the information, all peer-reviewed, all done right, no one changed. Doctors didn't change. Cardiologists didn't change. Even cardiologists that I hired at the Tri-State Healing Center were not familiar with it. They had their own idea. Everybody had their own ideas, but here was proof you could do it. So I want people to know how important it is. I'm also going to give you a sample of the Supremacy I use every day, the 240 vegan caps, and a serving of our hot chocolate, and also Cocoa Magic Bar. But most importantly is the cardio stuff. Now, why is the cardio stuff important? Well, first let's talk about the ingredients. You're looking at cacao, that's the raw chocolate, apples and bananas. You're also looking at almonds, rice bran, oat bran, Jerusalem artichoke, inulin, very important, flax meal, sunflower lecithin, blueberries, magnesium citrate, ascorbic acid, potassium citrate, ginkgo biloba, hawthorn berries, that's a superstar, papaya, pomegranate, reishi mushrooms, turmeric, blackberries, red wine, grapeseed extract, resveratrol, quercetin, coenzyme Q10, vitamin E, mixed tocopherols, ginseng panax, green tea, cayenne pepper, and oats. How about that? Quite simply, it is the most comprehensive, all-inclusive cardio blend that I could do. I know of no other in the world that comes close to it. And you're going to save about $100 today, over 50% of the value of the package. So this whole package is only going to cost you $99. So it's a big savings. But if you care about your health, cardio stuff, wonder what that's for. This is it, plus all the educational material you get with a call, 877-627-5065. Again, 877-627-5065. 5065 or call Neil in the Vitamin Closet Monday to Saturday, noon to 8 o'clock at 646-926-5430. All right? Because you should care enough about your health to bring in something that can really make a difference, something is really functional, and there's nothing else like it. Now we're going to go to Dr. Jonathan Haidt.
Teaching since 1987 when I started graduate school at Penn and then at Chicago and then for 16 or 17 years at the University of Virginia. And I thought the job of a teacher, or at least how to be a good teacher, is you provoke a variety of emotions during class, you get people to look at things from different perspectives, you lead them through a path which sometimes is uncomfortable, and then you resolve it. And so there can be like a dramatic structure to a class. And so that's the way I always taught, and I always trusted my students and felt that they trusted me. And then I moved to NYU in 2011, and it's not so much moving from UVA to NYU, it's that suddenly, for the first time, in the spring of 2014, I mean, it really was overnight, it was like from out of nowhere.
It was really strange.
In the spring of 2014, I had several incidents where students reported me to the dean and demanded that he do something about things I'd said in class, like teaching the Milgram experiment. One student thought that I was saying that the Nazis were okay. It was just this level of, you know,
said that. They weren't okay.
So there was just the sense that students would give you the benefit of the doubt because you're all in this together, you're trying to put on a great class together, that seemed to vanish after a couple of such complaints. And I was really puzzled. And one student was talking about issues in terms of I don't feel safe. And I was like, what do you mean? I couldn't understand it. And this was all in the spring of 2014. And so when Greg invited me to lunch in May of 2014, you know, it's sort of like, you know, like you're seeing, you know, people turn into zombies here and there, and suddenly a guy comes along and says, you know, in the lab, I just found this new kind of parasite. And so he told me his idea. I said, oh my God, this is brilliant. And I said, and I sort of suggested, oh, you should write that up, and I should write it up with you. That was the Origin of the Atlantic article.
A question for all of you. The one thing that all of you have in common is that you live on the East Coast of the United States in relatively privileged areas.
Queens.
John.
Well, Southeast D.C.
John, you just mentioned Penn, Chicago, Virginia, NYU. I don't see the University of Southern Kentucky on that list.
Right.
How certain are you that the phenomenon you're describing is national? Or do you think it is specific to privileged quarters of pampered American life?
Let me take that. Sure. Starters, because as we've been talking about the book around the country, I always ask a few different questions, and when I meet with administrators, I ask various questions. And one thing that I found is wherever you go, anywhere in America, if you're dealing with kids born after 1995, everybody from the college president through the professors, through the guitar teacher, through the counseling center, everybody is saying, what hit us? The anxiety, the depression, there's a tsunami of it. The soccer coach says, I mean, like all of a sudden, if you criticize a kid, you know, she won't come back to, you know, she quits the team. And so the fragility, the anxiety, the depression, that is totally national. The politicization of it, the idea that people are vulnerable, not me necessarily, but her and him and them, they're vulnerable, and therefore I'm gonna call you out and destroy you because you said something that I, you know, et cetera. It's that call out culture, that is not national. That is, if you look at the top liberal arts colleges in the Northeast and the West Coast and Chicago, you find it. In fact, that's where all the shoutdowns have been. We have a map at Heterodox Academy. We created a map where every shoutdown, where a speaker was literally shouted down so they couldn't speak, and it's all right along the Eastern Seaboard and the rim of the Pacific Coast and Chicago.
Yeah. So what's special about Lenora, why don't you start with...
Wait, I had a Kentucky story. I couldn't believe it. You mentioned a state that I know something about. So can I just tell you where
Yes. We're always open to Kentucky stories.
This is... that's the 92nd Street Wise motto. Where Kentucky stories live.
Highly specific.
Right. That's why I come here. So this lady wrote to me about a month ago. She's in Kentucky. And... every afternoon when her son, who's 9, gets dropped off by the school bus, the rule that the school has is that there has to be an adult waiting at the bus stop to walk him home. It's actually, you can see her house from the bus stop. And she has her father, normally walk him home. One day the dad was in the bathroom, and one day the kid wasn't supposed to come home, and so the grandfather wasn't waiting to walk him home. But if it becomes a third time neglecting this child, and the child has to go back to the bus depot, which seems like the least safe place you could possibly take a kid in Kentucky. But so you're wondering, how do kids get so fragile? They're being told, they're being forced to be supervised every single second, even in Kentucky. And then the reason, the rationale for that is that otherwise they're not safe. And it's like, they are safe. But if you're always being told that you're not safe, when you are safe, nothing seems safe. And I think that's why we hear the word, I don't feel safe on campus, because that's just become the watchword for everything.
And if I could just add one thing on the class issue, and I take the class issue extremely seriously, and in the book we recommend several books, including Putnam's Our Kids, which I think is just absolutely fabulous. I do feel like in my work at FIRE, we still see at schools that tend to be more sort of working class, more commuter schools, we still see cases exactly like the kind of cases I was seeing in 2005, where students are being told that they can't protest outside of a tiny little free speech zone. A lot of these sort of like administrators throwing their weight around, don't you dare criticize the university case. But when it comes to these highly ideological cases, we do see them at more elite colleges.
I can't locate it perfectly, but I can tell you that it is this generation and possibly a little bit of the generation right before it. You know, 1984, we started putting the pictures of the missing kids on milk cartons, and we neglected to say, by the way, this was a runaway, or this kid was taken in a custodial dispute.
Yep.
Right, in a divorce battle. And I think if you're growing up with, you know, here's your Rice Krispies and here's the person who's been missing, you know, it's like a series. And so that, I think, became, you know, we really became obsessed with the idea of predators and no child ever being safe. And that's when the crime really was ramping up.
Yeah.
From, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, it peaks in 93, but the fear keeps going even though the crime went down. So I can't say exactly when, but I do feel like this idea that any child that is not supervised is going to be snatched off their bike starts with the milk cartons.
But I think that's more the background, that's the pre-story. Mm-hmm. So Greg and I structured the book around this mystery of why is it so sudden? Why did it come out of nowhere with kids born in 1995?
Mm-hmm. And
so we think there's six different intersecting threads that really all come together. And that is one of them. That is the background of increasing paranoia. And Lenore's always talking about this. Somehow in the 90s or early 2000s, we got the idea that if you take your eye off your kid just to reach for a carton of milk, they're gonna be snatched.
Milk again!
That's right. But we think that there's two major factors here that combined. So one is the vast overprotection. The central idea in the book is that human beings are anti-fragile. That is, kids might look fragile, but actually the evolutionary design is for us to go out, fall down a few times, then we learn how to stand up. We reach for something, it drops, we learn how, you know. We're built to learn by trial and error, where kids seek out risk. Once they master something, they try to make it more dangerous. That's what they need to do. And beginning maybe in the 90s, we started saying, risk? How about zero? How about no risk? Is that good for you? And so we basically deprived them of the ability to develop their normal abilities as an autonomous human being. So that really ramps up in the 90s. And so we begin to get a more fragile generation. We begin to get kids who are not as robust. And then social media, I think, is the reason why the cutoff is so sharp,
yeah.
Because Facebook opens up. It used to just be for college students when it came.
Okay, there you're getting some good ideas. You all of you who are over the age of 50, you all remember what it was like growing up. You weren't micromanaged. You didn't have to have adult supervision every second of every day. You weren't overly protected. You knew there was cause and effect. You knew if you made mistakes, there was a price to pay. You knew if you were vulgar or you were mean-spirited or if you were a bully or if you were impolite, if you lacked manners, there would be a price to pay. There's no price to pay. So this is what happens when a whole society begins to forget what it is when they grew up and start trying to manufacture that there is no chance in someone's life to fail, make a mistake, or be held accountable. And that's what we have the consequence of today in no small measure. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for calling. I'm sorry we didn't get to more calls. I saw that a Barbara called and others. We'll get to you tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.